Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am a Jito Ryo master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
Network. I'm, of course, your Promptime host, Thomas Promptime Mattis, and on this episode, we start off Tsunami Month. Kind of an oxymoron of sorts, considering this is a site that is themed around Tsunami and the Tsunami generation to have a Tsunami Month when you think every month would be Tsunami Month at the same point in time. You know, it's kind of odd to have a podcasting site that is themed around Tsunami that says it represents the Tsunami generation and not have a Tsunami Month. So it goes both ways. But as I said, we start Tsunami Month, which means every show that we review this month, or movie for that matter, but it will be four individual shows, are shows that have been shown on Cartoon Network's Tsunami. So, for instance, you know, we're not going to be reviewing something like Full Metal Panic or something along the lines of Gurren Lagann, you know, because it hasn't been, you know, on Tsunami. For that matter, this also rules out things like Code Geass and Death Note. They've technically not been on Tsunami. They've been on Adult Swim. And again, I'm using air quotation marks in the way that Lewis Black uses that pointy finger. But, can you tell I've been watching a lot of Lewis Black lately, by the way? But, those were Adult Swim, not Tsunami. So everything has been on Tsunami. And for that matter, to give you sort of a preview of the sort of four shows we will be reviewing this month, all of them happened no later than 2001. So that should give you the time frame. In fact, actually, I think it's later than 2000, but just to be careful, it's 2001. But yeah, so all of this happened basically in the heyday of the greatness of sort of early Tsunami. And as far as this week's show is concerned, this week we are reviewing, in fact, one of those classics that happened in 2001. Yes, after Gundam Wing, you know, there had to be a show that came on that really got people excited, and there was, I think, one show that has become sort of a cult classic, fan favorite, and really, every time I watch it, I just get reminded of the greatness that is that whole era of anime that had, like, Gundam Wing, this show, shows like Cowboy Bebop, shows like 8th Mobile Suit Team, Rurouni Kenshin, Trigun, and of course, the show I'm talking about is Outlaw Star. Yeah, every time I watch the show, I'm reminded about that great era between, I want to say, 1996 and 2000. Maybe more of an appropriate is to say kind of 94 to 98, because that's when sort of CG started getting, and it used more computers to an extent. But really, I would say 96 to 2000, the anime that came out of that time frame, there just seems to be a soul to the drawings on screen, if that makes any sense. But yeah, Outlaw Star, again, it just takes me back to the era. It takes me back to that whole era of Toonami where it was golden, you know, before a certain female executive of Cartoon Network caved in to the, you know, mother groups and the Christian right groups and basically made Toonami all about Naruto and Prince of Tennis and, you know, all that stuff that completely failed and ruined Toonami. That is too long of a story to explain. Maybe at a later date we will explain it. But focus again on Outlaw Star. So yes, to get back on track, this week's review is Outlaw Star, and I can't wait to dive into my review. And maybe we should get started on that since we have no emails or comments or anything like that. Let's start off with cast. Outlaw Star, starring Robert Bob Buckles as Jean Starwin, Amelia Brown as Malfina, Ian Hawke as Jim Hawkins, Wendy Lee as Twilight Suzuka, Lenore Zahn as Aisha Klenklen, Peter Spells as Gilliam II, Edzar Wetz as Fred Lowe, Tom Weiner as Lord Hazanko, John Schneider as Ronald Ron McDougal, and Steve Stanley as Harry McDougal. So with that, let's move on to synopsis. Outlaw Star follows the adventures of a young outlaw named Jean Starwin and his partner Jim Hawkins, as they find a mysterious bioandroid by the name of Malfina, and eventually get a hold of a ship that they name the Outlaw Star. Along with their friends Twilight Suzuka and Aisha Klenklen, who join them, they go on search for adventures in space, including the search for the legendary galactic ley line. And with that, let's get right into our review of Outlaw Star. Get on with our review, and first, of course, we always have the music. And this is a particular great thing to talk about when it comes to this anime. Because, again, this is one of those legendary soundtracks. I think if you go to anybody around the net that talks about anime, they constantly have the Outlaw Star soundtrack rank as one of those greatest ever soundtracks. And with good reason. First, we're going to start off talking about the opening and closing themes, which are legendary upon themselves. The opening theme, again, you're just hearing it, you know, through the night. Just this awesome rock track, you know. I'm trying to find the words to describe it, and the only thing I find to describe it is to actually sing the tune itself. But it's just a wonderful little rock track that really gets you into the show and really captures the feel of Outlaw Star. You know, Outlaw Star has this very unique sort of action adventure space feel where it's sort of combined where the space is kind of like the sea and the age of the pirates, while at the same time also feeling like the Old West. And all of these themes and feelings really feel like they're condensed into this song. And it's just this awesome song that talks about, you know, grabbing hold of your fate, grabbing hold of your destiny, and never letting go. Which, again, really follows sort of the theme of the series, which is adventure. I mean, there isn't some deep underlying theme, as we maybe saw last week with Demon King Daimyo, that there was a deep underlying theme, but it was really, really underlying, or, you know, something like Evangelion or that stuff. I mean, really the theme here is adventure and the search of adventure. But there is a somewhat theme of, you know, the heroes learning to grab their own destiny, grab their own fate, and control it themselves. It's really not something that is really talked about. It's something that, you know, comes at the end, and it's sort of that small little lesson that they learned, you know. But they really do kind of have that lesson throughout the series. But in this song, it really captures that whole feel of that theme, along with the whole feel of the, you know, the act of adventure, you know, going into, you know, the unexplored, and just taking hold of something and seeing it through to the end. Again, just this great rock song that I really, really enjoy. And then you follow that with both the first and second ending theme, which, you know, I'm going to play back to back. I'm going to play them back to back right here. I mean, just listen to them. I mean, you'll instantly have this feel of nostalgia here.
Thank you.
mean, anybody who watched Nami, during this time and remembers watching Outlaw Star, instantly you have that nostalgic feel for music. And again, this is really something that today's animation, and I say today's animation, because I'm not just including Japanese anime, because it includes Japanese anime, but it really is also American animation. Well, all of this, they've lost the art of not just the opening theme, but the closing theme. And you know how I talk about how the opening theme is usually this pump-up track that gets you excited and pumped up for the show, and then sort of the ending track, you know, is this sort of soft, mellow, you know, calm down, that but yet still keeps you excited for the next episode. Again, we see that here, and this is one of those prime examples where, you know, we first saw this. And these two songs, these two ending themes, especially when you combine them with the animation that is shown on screen, which is, you know, it's images of, you know, I guess drawings and paintings done by, I want to say, the lead character designer. So, and I apologize for not having his name in front of me. But again, you know, I think anybody who remembers Toonami and remembers Outlaw Star remembers these ending themes and these wonderful songs, these soft, you know, haunting melodies played with, you know, those wonderful fantasy images in the background. And really, that is really what lends, I think, to the legacy and sort of the nostalgia for these themes. You know, these songs, you know, again, like I said, just haunting melodies that, I'll be honest, I listen to them and I cry a bit. You know, they're really just that beautiful of music. It's just, this is what music is. This is the cornerstone of what music should be. This beauty, this grandeur of greatness, this out of control feeling that you feel when you listen to this music. And again, that first ending theme also being Melfina's sort of lullaby adds to it. So yeah, I mean, opening, closing theme definitely helped make this anime legendary. And then you have the overall score of the show, which doesn't disappoint either. There is some great music. I think a perfect sort of mend of sort of modern and classic. And I think no theme perfectly represents this than Twilight Suzuka's theme, which, you know, sort of has that Japanese samurai feel to it, and yet has this sort of upbeat modern feel to it combined, and it's this wonderful theme. Like, the comical theme is memorable, and look, you know, it's, again, yeah, it's a comical theme, but it feels more to a comical theme. When you hear this theme, you think of Outlaw Star. You know, sort of the action theme, you know, the hero theme, which sort of a play off the opening theme, really, I feel, represents Gene and Jim perfectly. Melfina's theme is beautiful and haunting. Aisha's theme, again, perfectly represents her. Every theme and every piece of music in this anime fits what it's supposed to do. It fits its area and really enhances it. It's obvious, it's beautiful to listen to, and yet when you hear it in the show, it's not something to where it's overpowering. Not quite like, you know, oh, I don't know, a certain scene in the latest Amazing Spider-Man movie where it's like, okay, we get it, you want us to buy the soundtrack, it's nice music, can you stop now? And for more on my thoughts of Amazing Spider-Man, head over to www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com within the next couple of weeks when the latest episode of Comic Book Crazy comes out. But back to our regular schedule, Tom's prerogative review of Outlaw Star. The music is just wonderful here, and it really brings the flavor and the wonderful feeling of this show out in all its grandness. I just love it for that reason. With that being said, we are going to move on to animation. And let's start off with the overall style of Outlaw Star. I really, really do enjoy the style. Again, I go back to nostalgia because overall, I mean, the main basis of the style is definitely something that you would think of, again, of this era of Japanese anime. You know, the era of, I'll even say 94, or really started in 92, but you know, so I'll say 92 to basically 98/2000. This feel of this anime, really the basis of this great hand-drawn style with soul, is the way I put it. Because really it is. It's hand-drawn, but there is a soul to this. That every time you watch this, and I'm talking about shows like this, Trigun, Gundam Wing, Escaflowne, Ninja Scrolls, Evangelion, there is a soul within the animation that you feel it deep in your heart. This, again, like Gundam Wing, like most of these shows I just mentioned, when you watch this show, it's hard not to kind of get fanboys about it, which makes it really hard to review, because the animation is very good, but you add on to that the feelings you get from seeing the animation, nostalgia feelings, this feeling of like, this is how animation is supposed to be done. And I know I'm acting the all old fogey, and I had to walk 15 miles in the snow to get me anime. But, you know, it's that thing to where it really is, there is a huge difference between the sort of feelings of soul and just this feelings of grandeur that this beautiful animation has compared to what we see today. And I am really bringing stuff like Death Note, Code Geass, when I say that. Because as beautiful as the animation is there, and it is definitely unique, at the same time, it just feels all the same. Whereas here, there's a certain base style that is similar, but it all feels different, and it all feels unique, and it all stands out on its own. And one of the ways it makes it stand on its own is there's a certain softness with a lot of the characters that I really do enjoy. Especially within body tone, coloring, and stuff like that. It really is a great sort of style. And another part of that is really also the style when it comes to clothing and sort of spaceship design and everything. And we'll get more into spaceship design in a little bit after character design. It really is this feeling of sort of the blend of the modern and the old. And again, there's this theme of, you know, everything that's new is old and everything old is new. You know, again, it's how sort of the past repeats itself and the past is present in the future. Because again, like I said before, this whole thing to where, you know, commonly where they talk about space the same way they sort of talked about the sea, you know, 400 years ago. And also sort of how it's also like the Old West in some places. There are individual episodes where you definitely get the feeling like this is sort of a classic sort of sea storyline. And then there's other storylines that I feel like a classic Old West sort of Western storyline. Though we'll get more into sort of favorite episodes later. And a reason I say that is because there are episodes of this anime that I feel are some of the greatest individual episodes of an animation ever. And we'll get into those too later on, which should keep you listening to this show to find out what those two episodes are. But with that being said, let's move on to character designs. And we're going to start with Jean Starwin. And the first thing I have to say is I love the grittiness of Jean's design. You know, the character and everything that happens within the character history. You know, there should be a grittiness, and I love it. I love the star tattoo. It's something that does help make Jean look unique, along with the red hair and the scars on his face. And it's like, you know, he looked like a badass, and I'll get into acting later, but again, just the look of him, he looks like an outlaw. He looks like this sort of blend of bad and good, you know. He really does look the look of an anti-hero, I think is the best way to put it. Because look, it makes sense, but I think you get what I'm saying. He really does feel like this anti-hero. Someone who does good, you know, he just he does have alternative motives, you know? And then you have Melfina, and I just love the softness of Melfina's character design. Everything in her character design is so subtle. You know, very unique hairstyle, yet it's not extravagant and out there. It's subtle. You know, her clothes, you know, the fact that she kind of wears a sort of spender, sort of shorts, sort of dress shirt combination. Again, everything about it is subtle. Her beauty is subtle. You know, the way she moves is subtle. The way she is drawn is very, very subtle. Then you have Jim Hawkins. I definitely see a lot of inspiration of Jim Hawkins in this character design. You know, it's obviously that his character design was definitely influenced by, you know, the whole treasure planet Jim Hawkins. You know, because definitely he feels that way, and there's certain scenes within the show that sort of reminds me of that. But yeah, again, they actually say it in the anime during sort of the opening of one of the shows, how he really is the polar opposite of Gene. And really, that's true. In his character design, pretty much everything, he is the polar opposite of Gene Starwin. And that's what makes them such a great team and a great pairing, is that they're the opposite of each other, which helps both characters immensely. Twilight Suzuka, immediately, you know, just sort of what seems like sort of Snow White Japanese aspect of her character design that I really, really love here. And it's such a unique design, and I love sort of the color scheme within her clothing. Just, again, that whole white aspect, that sort of pure aspect of her soul and of her character that it represents. And again, the sort of the red and the origins, just to bring out a bit of color, I think works perfectly here. And it's just this wonderful, wonderful design, like really representing sort of the old world, sort of Japanese feel that is her character. Aisha Clan Clan, the cat girl, because you always need a cat girl. There's nothing wrong with having a cat girl. But, very unique design. Just, you feel just the energy that comes out of her character design. And again, the whole Kitaro race is very, very unique looking. And I enjoy it for that much. And again, the whole braided hair and the ring at the bottom of her hair and everything. Everything just really makes it feel like this whole... There's definitely a Mongolian feel to her character design that I really, really like when you look deeply into it. Then you have Gilliam too. And you see Gilliam in two aspects. One is on the monitor, and then the little robots. They're really simple. I mean, the robots are these cylinder things that extend and have little arms and everything. But the thing I love about here, and I love when people are able to do characters like this, that are these inanimate objects, whether they be the little robots or that face. And yet, there seems to be such emotion drawn with these characters. They do these little movements, and yet, they have so much character within them. And a lot of it has to do with the acting, but here, again, you know, for instance, I'll use a scene as an example. In an episode where the McDougals are trying to get Melfina, and, you know, on Fei Fong, and Ronald has, you know, pretty much tricked Gene and the rest of the crew, with the exception of Melfina, like 30 minutes away while Harry tries to kidnap Melfina. Melfina manages to get to the ship and, you know, tells Gillian to open it up and, you know, what's wrong, Melfina? And then he looks and Harry's charging across, you know, the sort of launch pad gate towards the ship, and he goes, oh my! And the robot opens up, and the arms come out, and it looks like this genuine look of shock on this little inanimate object that really doesn't have a face. I mean, it has eyes and everything, but it doesn't have a mouth. It shouldn't look shocked, but it does. And it's just wonderful art here. You know, the different emotions that you feel from Gilliam in this anime are just a beauty to watch. It really shows artists at the top of their craft being able to make, you know, Gilliam work. If Gilliam doesn't work, it really could have hurt the anime, but it worked perfectly and it was beautiful to look at. Because again, it made the ship feel like it was part of the crew. It made the ship feel alive. and like it was an actual person rather than just some inanimate object and plot device to get the, you know, the characters from point A to point B and have cool mech fights, which we'll get to in a second. And last but not least, with character designs, we have the others. And again, you know, the McDougal brothers, you know, Lord Hazanko, you know, again, all of the antagonists had wonderful designs that, and they really all felt unique. And the same could really be said for a lot of the characters. From, you know, Fred Lowe and, you know, characters like that, all the way to sort of the foot soldiers, the ninja sort of pirates, which really looked unique and really had a creepy feel to them that I very much enjoyed. With that, let's move on to the mech designs. And I love the mech designs. You know, such inventive ways to create spaceships, sort of modernized takes on them, and yet still containing sort of a classic feel to them. There are spaceships that look like, you know, sort of ocean liners and stuff like that. You know, Kitaro spaceships with their sort of like spiral out sort of design and everything that looks unique. But of course, my favorite here is the Outlaw Star, the XGP, as it's also known. And one of the reasons I love the design of the Outlaw Star itself really is because it's sort of this very modernized take on sort of that classic rocket design. I mean, when I see the Outlaw Star, I'm very much reminded, and unfortunately I don't have the name of the ship in front of me, but again, for anybody who's seen Godzilla vs. Monster Zero, and by the way, for more on my review of Godzilla vs. Monster Zero, head on over to Tokyo SOS, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com, and listen to, I want to say, episode 7, which contains my review of Godzilla vs. Monster Zero. But back again to our regular scheduled program of reviewing Outlaw Star on Tom's Prerogative. But, you know, it reminds me of the spaceship from Godzilla vs. Monster Zero that Earth builds and flies to Planet X. Just that sort of very classic sort of science fiction rocket. You know, with the four sort of rocket things and sort of the streamlined look. You know, I love it. It just looks gorgeous. And I love sort of the nostalgic feel within its design. And I really think that helps make, again, add to the wonderful feeling of this anime through its animation. You know, and again, also within that, the color scheme, red and blue, the colors just pop off the screen watching this anime. It makes the mech fights just wonderful to watch. Moving on to special effects, I love the special effects here. They pop off the screen, they feel organic, and they flow perfectly within the animation. It's wonderful to look at. The explosions are great. Again, to lightning effects and stuff like that, dust and everything. You know, it really feels organic as part of the animation. It never feels like it's computer or anything else. It feels like it was drawn alongside, you know, the character designs and stuff like that, even though I know it was added on later. But again, it just feels organic, and again, adds to that nostalgic feel. And then the backgrounds, you know, there's so many different locations they go to. They go to a hot springs, they go to a prison planet, they go to a water world, they go to Haifong, which is this big city. They're sort of in this small little city on Sentinel 3. So many different locations, and all the backgrounds are just beautiful and gorgeous, whether they be in space or, again, on a planet. Wonderful drawn. A lot of great detail was really, I think, put into, you know, how does Haifong City look? You know, how is it different from everything else? You really can see that the time, patience, and detail were put into the backgrounds of what they would contain and really help make each location feel unique and different. So with that being said, we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to dive into acting and story. So we'll be right back, folks.
The funeral is over. Jonathan Kent is on the mend.
So, how's Clark's father?
Oh, much, much better.
Lois has returned home.
Lois, over here!
Harry, wife? Since when did you start meeting your staff at the airport? How'd you know I was returning on that flight?
A good editor checks out his hunches, Lois. I got a hot story of one you want straight away. I'm parked over here.
But just as Metropolis has learned to live without the Man of Steel...
I know, there was only one Superman, but Metropolis just hit the jackpot. Because we got four Supermen now, and nobody knows which of them, if any, is the real McCoy.
Four beings of incredible power and intellect have laid claim to the Man of Steel's name.
The last son of Krypton.
I live.
The Man of Steel.
Man of Steel coming through! Nobody move! This is a bust!
The Cyborg.
Yes, I'm Superman. I'm back.
The Boy of Steel.
Put me down!
Listen, pal, don't ever call me Superboy. Capiche?
The reign of the Superman is upon us, and so from crisis to crisis, a Superman podcast begins its epic coverage of this last act in the epic Death and Return of Superman saga. Every week, Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor, along with the best and the brightest in the podcasting community, will cover this event in all of its forms, from the comics to the novelizations, to the audio drama, and beyond. Superman is back, but is any of them the real Man of Steel? Find out on From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, located at www.supermanhomepage.com and www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be! It's still going up!
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension.
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
In June of 1962, a superhero unlike any other made his first appearance in the pages of Amazing Fantasy number 15, the final issue of that series. 6 months later, this character would receive his own title, and from there he would grow in popularity and be adapted into several animated series, a handful of live-action series both in the US and abroad, have countless action figures made in his likeness, dominate the cinema screen, and much, much more. It is fair to say that the Amazing Spider-Man is a pop culture icon and a fictional character that people all over the world identify with and love. This year, Spider-Man is turning 50, and Views from the Long Box, an internet radio series hosted by me, Michael Bailey, is going to celebrate the wall crawler in a series of episodes focusing on various aspects of the character's existence. Together with such podcasting luminaries as Brad Douglas, Andrew Leyland, John Wilson, and Scott Gardner, I'm going to give Spidey the biggest birthday card a comic fan could. He may not be my favorite character, but I like him a great deal, and he deserves the spotlight in this, his 50th year. Views from the Long Box can be found at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com. New episodes hit every Friday. Views from the Long Box is a Fortress of Baletude production in association with the DiMonzo Corps of Milan, Italy.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it with acting. And we're going to start off with protagonist acting. Really, all the protagonists here did a wonderful job. From Bob Buchholz to Lenore Zen to Peter Spellos. And again, the voice acting here really added the soul, within the performance. I kind of caught myself there because I really feel so much has soul. You know, the animation lends soul, the music lends soul, the acting lends soul, and the story has soul to it. So everything really has soul. But again, these actors really helped lend soul to these characters that just their character designs alone couldn't do. You know, Bob Buchholz did an absolutely wonderful job as Gene Starwin. Again, just the cockiness, it really is the best way to put it, of Gene Starwin that makes him such a unique character. You know, Bob did a wonderful job implementing that into the voice. You know, he's a confident person, and when he's serious, you know, there's really a strong character there. But again, just the cockiness and just like, yeah, I'm a badass and I know it. So why don't you step up to the plate? You know, I love that. And Amelia Brown, you know, really did a wonderful job as Malfina. You know, again, that whole thing about her character being subtle and sort of the subtlety in that voice of this character who just wants to know who she is and where she came from. It was wonderful to hear. You know, again, Ian Hawke, she did a... I don't have the name in front of me, but Ian Hawke is a name actually used by a voice actress. One of these days, I'm going to ask a voice actor why they use different names sometimes. That's besides the point. Again, actually, sort of interesting note, the voice actress who uses the name Ian Hawke is Jim Hawkins. Also was the voice of Circuit on Power Rangers Time Force. That's besides the point. But yeah, again, back on focus of characters and, you know, acting here. Along with the other protagonists, did a great job, each of their characters. And sort of the, again, the whole purity aspect by Wendy Lee added to Twilight Zazuka that really made her feel unique. You know, very soft-spoken, you know, let her actions, you know, show off instead of her words. And then just with Lenore Zen of Aisha Clan Clan, again, that whole energy aspect, you hear that energy in her voice. And of course, back to, you know, Jim Hawkins being that polar opposite of Gene, really, again, really being brought out with the voice. My favorite voice of the protagonist here, though, is Peter Spellos. And again, that whole aspect of you have just basically sort of this circular thing and a red thing that goes around that kind of acts like a face on the bridge and those little robots. And yet, again, the soul from the voice acting that Peter Spellos adds into the characters is just wonderful. That he adds into Gilliam 2. Again, it just Gilliam 2 is probably one of my favorite characters in this anime. Just because, you know, just the fun of the character. It makes me enjoy it just that much. And then, of course, you have the antagonist, your Lord Hazanko, and Ron McDougall, and Harry McDougall. And again, all the voice actors here, Steve Stanley, John Schneider, Tom Whitner, they all did a wonderful job. You know, each of these characters had their own uniqueness. You know, Lord Hazanko was sort of the big bad who, like, again, leader of the Unsung Seven. He really didn't get voice work until the end, but, you know, even though you saw bits and pieces of him throughout the series, he still had this feeling of intimidation and stuff like that. And a lot of that came from the voice. And then, of course, the McDougal brothers, again, just the complete opposite of Gene, you know? You know, they're cocky, but they're cocky in sort of that bad way, you know, we're outlaws and we do whatever the hell we want. You know, that sort of villainous side of maybe what Gene would be. And so I love that difference there, and I love that feeling. And just to add on to that, with Harry McDougal, again, the sort of insanity of Harry that Steve Stanley put into the character, you know, when it concerns to Malfina and just his obsession with her, you really feel that obsession. Again, the voice work is just wonderful here. Steve Stanley did a wonderful job of inputting that sort of slight insanity into his obsession that really, really made you believe this character was something to be scared of. You know, to an extent, Harry's kind of scarier than his brother. His brother's just a good fighter with connections to, a lot of great weapons. But, because Harry, as the series goes along, becomes more and more machine, he becomes more and more scarier. And you can really feel that in the voice. With that, let's move on to story. First talking point, though, we'll talk about is, again, the main plot and search for the Galactic Ley Line. Really, the main plot is very much underplayed in this series. I mean, it's a strong focus, but for most of the series, it's really underplayed. More towards the final eight, it become big again. It played a lot at the beginning, what's the Galactic Ley Line, and played a lot more at, again, those final eight. But sort of in the middle, it's kind of underplayed. It's the theme driving what they're doing, but it's kind of not talked about a lot. It's more of the focus, again, in the middle, there's more of a focus on, the things that are happening around them and, people trying to hunt them down. Which, again, goes towards that main plot, but it feels like it's underplayed, which I actually like. I think that helps the plot a lot. Because really, the main plot is just a simple adventure. There is this supposed treasure called the Galactic Ley Line. Everybody is after it. Gene, with Malfina and the Outlaw Star are pretty much the only people who could really penetrate because that's what the ship was created for. That's what Malfina was created for. Malfina was basically, she has this other self that is basically the lady of the ley line that opens the gate and everything. And that whole search for who she is throughout the series, which has some very deep meaning to it, and has a lot of beautiful moments in that whole plot line. But again, it really is just this simple adventure, hey, we need to get to the treasure first type of storyline. And that's why I say underplaying it and not making it just every single episode and everything is about, the Galactic Ley Line, really helped the main plot of the story. To an extent, there are really two main plots. There is this, and really to an extent, the Galactic Ley Line is kind of a sort of side plot. Because really, this is a story about the crew of the Outlaw Star, whose mission is to go beyond the beyond and find races of different kind and have sex with little green women. I'm Gene Starwind. I fly the Outlaw Star. Please don't look at my toupee. Oh, I'm silly today. But no. But again, there's really those two main plots. The main plot, story-wise, is the Galactic Ley Line. But the other is, it's about the crew and the Outlaw Star and their interactions with each other. And that really helps lend itself to why this plot is so good. Especially in that middle, because it is about those characters. And it lends itself for most of the episodes to being character-driven episodes and not an entire series that is driven by this one very simple storyline that is basically a treasure hunt and allows it to be underplayed, it really makes that whole mystery of the Galactic Ley Line that much better and that much enjoyable. I don't know if I would have enjoyed you know, the whole finding of the Galactic Ley Line had it not been for, you know, the whole other main plot about it being the Outlaw Star and its crew. And that is actually our next talking point, which is, you know, the other main plot, which is the crew of the Outlaw Star and their interactions with each other. Again, how they join the crew, whether it be Twilight Zazuka, you know, her pride and kind of falling in love with Gene, you know, and being interested in him, being that he was able to defeat her and stop her from assassinating Fred Lowe, to Asa Clan Clan, you know, what led her to eventually joining the crew. And sort of this very family aspect of the crew, and again, the partnership between Jim and, you know, Gene, you know, and sort of this brother aspect, the very subtle romance that blossoms by the end of the series between Gene and Malfina, which, as a hopeless romantic, this is exactly how I love to see a great romantic, you know, storyline evolve through a series and blossom at the end. You know, it is a... You can see that they're made for each other by the end of the series, and you can see how they grew and start to love each other, and it was wonderful to see. And again, their interactions with each other, and just a lot of the episodes, again, being character-driven. And I think that is a huge problem with today's anime. Today's anime, a lot of it, I take that back. In the past 30 years, it's been better, and there's been a lot better anime. And the reason for that is because the anime of the past 3 years, a lot of it has been character-driven, again. As opposed to kind of what happened, you know, in from 2005 to 2009, to where it was plot-driven. It was theme-driven. Oh, we have an underlying theme. It drives the entire plot. Not understanding, to an extent, every story has been told. You know, and I say this before, and I'll say it again. And I always say it for that matter. I could sit here and I can basically tell the same story 30 different ways. You know, guy saves girl. Guy is a knight and girl is a princess. Guy is a space rogue. A girl is space alien. You know, refugee. It being the knight saves the princess. It could be in space. It could be in, you know, Japan. It could be in Mexico. It could be in Europe. It could be in Africa. It could be in India. It could, you know, taking different cultural designs. But what would make any of those stories interesting would be the character-driven plot and the characters and why they are doing this. You understand why all these characters are doing these things. You know, and again, a lot of those episodes really help that. You understand these characters. You come to love these characters. You come to enjoy being around these characters', you know, presence and seeing their next adventure. And that really, again, helps that second main plot, because it is just a simple action-adventure storyline. The next point we'll talk about is the filler episodes, and I love the filler episodes. Again, like I said, especially most of the, you know, I mean, I think there's a fair number of filler and sort of main plot episodes. I think the space race is definitely sort of main plot storyline. But there's a lot of little filler episodes that are just wonderful. In fact, there are three episodes that I think stand out when it comes to the filler episodes. One, I think, is the best individual animation episode that really stars a strong independent female character, that being episode 6, which features Twilight Zazuka. And then there are two other episodes that I think, bar none, are the best anime episode, or should I say, best episodes of an anime ever made. My personal feeling. And those are the Cracker Jet Bomber episode, and the whole Return to the Water Planet Treasure Planet episode. Both these episodes are just superb. Starting off with the Water Planet, again, I kind of made the joke, but it really is. It is basically Treasure Planet. That is the whole point. The old guy is Long John Silver, to an extent. You know, and it kind of funny because one of the characters of the Outlaw Star is named Jim Hawkins. That whole, you know, sort of sea storyline aspect. Sea is kind of like space, yada yada yada. It sounds like I don't care, but I do. But you've heard me say it over and over again in this review, so I won't bore you. But again, it really is that whole aspect. It's just this classic sort of treasure hunt. You know, this plan to outsmart these demons and getting there. And this whole connection that Pops has, you know, with his crew. And that very, very heartfelt scene at the end to where he basically dies, where he flies into, you know, I've accomplished my dream. Now I have one more dream to get revenge for my comrades. And it's just this connection that Gene automatically feels with the old man, you know, being at their outlaws, and this sort of sense of respect that you feel for him realizing his dream and accomplishing his dream. And it really did lend itself to what would go on later on the plot, inspiring Gene to, again, follow his dream and accomplish his dream. And then there's Cracker Jack. I love this episode. And ladies and gentlemen, can we just call this episode what it is? The anime episode that is inspired by Die Hard. Because when you look at it, that's what it is. It's basically the episode is basically the plot of every Die Hard movie. Robbers acting like terrorists so that they can rob people. The only thing missing from this episode was when Cracker Jack and his crew open up the space station, you know, security gates on the stores, was Beethoven's Ninth Symphony playing in the background. You know, and of course Cracker Jack saying Merry Christmas. For all those who remember that scene from Die Hard. But really, that's what it is. He does that. Gene eventually figures out the bomb. And it's just this great mystery of where is the bomb? Where is the bomb? I'm like, oh, wait, this is it. Which makes sense. And of course, Twilight and, you know, Aisha doing their own thing to sort of stall them. And I just love the way it ends to where Gene crashes the ship into the space station. It's like, oh, yeah, I disarmed your bomb. That was a fun couple of hours, Cracker Jack, and just that uppercut, you know, right before he says that, like, yeah, it's an awesome episode. It's just one of the best episodes of an anime ever made. It is a joy to watch. I will watch that episode over and over and over again, and I think these episodes are a perfect example of what a lot of the filler does. The filler, again, it provides, they are these character-driven stories to where the characters do learn something about themselves or have a significant moment in their life that really drives them to what they do later in the series. With the exception of kind of two. I say kind of two because one, but I kind of remembered another one that kind of happened before that episode I was thinking about. I want to say episode 20 or 21. Actually, I believe it's a 20. I'm having time. It's either 20 or 21, but I'll move on. Basically, the episode where Jim meets the female assassin that he doesn't know is a female assassin, and they have sort of this relationship and date, and you know he goes back to see her, but doesn't know that he pretty much actually led to killing her. It's sad, but you know, again, it's. It leads to an important moment of, you know, Jim sort of learning to grow up. Because Jim is grown up, but he really is still a kid. And so he has sort of, here's an adult moment for you. It's really sad. I kind of feel sad that the cats died, because I'm a cat person. Which makes me sound very, very horrible. But the real episode I was talking about is episode 23. Which is the Hot Springs episode, a.k.a. the episode that was cut from Toonami broadcast. So if you've not seen Outlaw Star on DVD, and you've only seen it on Toonami, you've not seen this episode. Because it was entirely cut out, because there's a lot of sexual content. In fact, there is an entire shot of Aisha naked and her boobies out there. And she is furry all over, by the way. But you do see nipples. The whole basis of the plot is how Jean gets more castor shells. If you watched episode 24 and wonder how did he get all those castor shells, well, he got them because he was told where the castor shells originated, which is this planet that is a tourist destination because it's basically a planet of hot springs. Which means you have all the female characters in bathing suits. There's tons of boobage. There's Jim being, you know, glumped by girls who think he looks cute. There's a whole joke of, you know, Aisha was like, this isn't hot. And eventually she finds a place that's hot that's kind of like lava. But it's pretty much a comedy episode. And it reminds me, I have this wonderful AMV of like all sort of these sort of sleazy scenes of Outlaw Star, along with sleazy scenes from other sort of shows. But it's put to the music of Weapon of Choice from Fatboy Slim. But enough of that. It's just this funny episode. And I kind of like, it does have its place. While there really isn't any character-driven moments from this episode, the episode does help sort of lighten the mood before the seriousness that is the final three episodes. So every episode in this series, whether they be filler or main plot, has its place and it works perfectly. You know, the fact of the matter is, again, that episode that's basically comedy, if it wasn't at that place, it wouldn't work in the series. It would feel out of place. But it was in the perfect place as far as the lineup is concerned. And it does explain, you know, again, where does Jean get the caster shell? So it's really a look into sort of the whole caster gun aspect. Which, you know, again, caster guns used to be called spell guns because they were basically ways to cast spells. Let's move on and let's talk about series pace. Again, this is another aspect that this series does perfectly. The series pace here is absolutely wonderful. It's organic. Everything flows. I know I talk about pace a lot, and I constantly talk about sort of the organic flow and everything, but it really does help. When a series has a very, very good organic flow, and nothing feels out of place, because there's no episode that feels like it should be someplace else. There's no episode that feels awkward or like it could be skipped. You know, everything is, it's not just that it's a joy to watch, but, you know, it's also that aspect to where every episode feels like it has a place in the story and adds something to the story. And it leads to the pace of the series feeling great. And you do feel like you've gotten this complete adventure by the end of it. So I love the fact that the series pace is perfect like that. With that, we're going to move on to our final talking point, and that is the fights. And again, mech fights and sort of on-the-ground fights. The fights here are the pin you win. The action in this series is just epic. Again, you know, sort of, again, shootouts you have sort of sword play that looks beautiful. And then, of course, spaceships fighting. Again, sort of the unique idea of grappler ships and the fact that, you know, ships grapple with each other and everything. You know, the fighting in this series is a work of art upon itself. And I love the fights. Some of my favorite... I love the fights in the episode... I believe it's called World's Strongest Women. It's Aisha episode. But it's basically the episode where Fred Lowe has... hires Jean basically to try to stop a female fighter from winning the female strongest person competition, because he basically is apparently engaged to this woman and made a promise to her that she wins 5 straight times, he will marry her, and she's won it 4 straight times, and he doesn't want to marry her, because, again, Fred Lowe, we didn't talk about him much, he's a great sort of comedic relief, he also is gay. Cartoon Network really toned it down, but, I also think it's something that, you know, again, when you're younger, you really don't notice, oh, somebody's acting gay or not. But, you know, as you get old, like, oh, yeah, he's gay. The Gator is indeed red. Ding, 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 ding. And again, I'm not saying there's anything wrong. That's what he is. He is, they make it quite obvious that his sexuality is that he is homosexual and that he's attracted to Gene, which again adds to comedy relief when they're dealing with each other. But yeah, the fight in sort of that whole strong women was great. The fight with the first assassin that attacks him, I enjoy, because it sort of does have this sort of old west feel to it. The first fight between Gene and Ronald McDougal, I thought was done wonderfully. And of course the fights in, again, because I said it was a wonderful episode, but episode 6, which was the first appearance of Twilight Zazuka, the fights between Zazuka and Gene were done wonderfully. And that's just a few of my favorites. The fights in this series are just epic. They're wonderful. The spaceship fights are a joy to watch. A lot of the scenes where the spaceship is flying, for that matter, again, it brings you back to that sort of nostalgic feel of them, how they showed spaceships, you know, fighting and that stuff, which I just love. So, I love the fighting. On to final talking points. I do want to bring up, because I found this in my research, they actually did kind of plan a second series. I'm kind of glad that they didn't do it, only because I think what they were planning was wrong. Part of what they were planning was they were going to have Gene and Jim in a new spaceship called, I guess, the Sword of Wind or something like that. I think it would have made very little sense to have them in a new spaceship, you know, to be honest. But that is something I found that was interesting, because I think a lot of people want more Outlaw Star. And that really lends itself to, you know, what my rating for this is. This is a classic anime. It's a nostalgic anime. And it's all that because it is great. It's, again, that whole simplicity of just a simple action-adventure story. Again, it's a treasure hunt. It's the combination of sort of, you know, outlaws and pirates and the lawless and the lawful. You know, again, just a simple action-adventure story to find this treasure, and yet it's just as much about that as it is about this crew of outlaws and assassins and cat girls and bioandroids, you know, and their adventures in the sort of this future where, you know, people are in space. And it is just about much about the characters as it is about that treasure. And at the end of the show, really the treasure is the adventure you have had with this crew. And for that reason, it makes it a classic. It makes it nostalgic. It makes Outlaw Star a perfect representation of what was great about the late 90s when it comes to animation coming out of Japan. So at the end of the day, I give this series a 5 out of 5. And more importantly, I highly suggest that this anime be a part of any anime fans collection, and for that matter, any animation fans collection. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Remember, if you have any comments about, you know, this review, you know, any suggestions, anything you agree with, anything you disagree with, or anything you want to say about the site in general, remember, you can find me several different ways. One, you can email me at absolution132@yahoo.com. That's absolution132@yahoo.com. You can also leave us a comment on our Facebook page that you can find by searching out Absolution Network on Facebook. And also, while you're there, remember, you can also leave comments on our site, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. And of course, while you're at the site, make sure you check out the Otaku Momentum, and of course, all the other 132 production sites and podcasts out there, like Random Red Box Reviews and Flashpoint, and of course, my other podcasting sites that I do as part of the network, that include, you know, again, Tokyo SOS and Comic Book Crazy, which I pimped already, but again, just so you have the site's web address, Tokyo SOS is at www.tokyosos.132productions.com, and Comic Book Crazy is at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And of course, while you're at any of our sites, make sure you check out our friends on the sidebar of the site. That includes people like Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box, and From Crisis to Crisis that he does with his good friend Jeffrey Taylor. Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Slyker's Major Spoilers Podcast, and of course, God Gardner's Two True Freaks, and many more on that sidebar. Check out their podcast. They do wonderful stuff. Again, help support my friends. I'd rather you help support them before you listen to me, because again, they do great stuff. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next week, we put on our cape and cowl as we dive in to Batman, the Animated Series, Volume 1, Season 1. So until next time, my Toonami generation, stay golden.
A cursed samurai. You have succeeded again in eluding my effort, but I am not worried. For one day you will fail.
DJ Clark Nova, don't sleep on it.